Hello, everyone. Here we are again. It's been about a month since the last podcast. This is the evening of June 3rd, 2015. It's a very pleasant evening here in Winnipeg. I hope things are well in your part of the world. It's been an interesting month. The weather's been bouncing around quite a bit. One day there might be snow, and a week later it's about 30 degrees above Celsius. We've had somebody new start working at the warehouse where I work, so there's been a bit of an adjustment, getting used to a new personality. And what else? Well, this month I happened to read a book titled The Big Fat Surprise, which looked at the existing scientific research into saturated animal fat and whether or not it is good or bad for human beings. And much to my surprise, it turns out that most of the research over the last 60 years has pointed out that saturated animal fat is actually good for human beings, even though for the last 60 years, the scientists who, most of the scientists who know about that research have been telling us that it's bad for us. So, yeah, quite an interesting read. I've had about four people write in this past month, and we'll get down to their questions right away. First, as always, I want to thank those of you who have sent in questions or comments. I want to thank those who have sent in donations. I want to thank those who ordered Boudescence through the website. And as always, I want to thank Marcus Fellows for establishing this website in the first place and for continuing to post these responses each month. And again, as is my habit at this point, for those of you who are new to the website and you may be having difficulty relating to some of the responses, if you're interested, you may want to listen to the two main talks on the website. If you go to the Listen Dropbox, you go down to the title Talks, you click on that, it will bring up two talks. The first is titled An Overview of Spiritual Awakening, and the second is titled Acknowledging the Moment. All right, so we'll get down to the questions that have come in. A first person has written in to say, "Hi, Daryl. I've asked about this issue before, but here we go again. In your April talk, you said that the blaming of others, to some extent, drops away when the true nature of doership is understood. I agree, and this has truly happened in my life, but like you said, to some extent. Of course, there can't be any blanket statement about this because every body mind is unique and there is such a wide range of experience. But I'm curious as to how far this can go. After your talk, I went for a walk. I really enjoy walking at this time of the year when nature wakes up. So there I was feeling quite peaceful in the afterglow of your talk, listening to the various birds tweeting and chirping. There were three young men walking by near the popular Frisbee golf track. I noticed that one of them was quite drunk and he was pointing in my direction and laughing. Ed said something nasty about me to his buddies. Anger started to arise in my system. I did not say anything back. I just walked by. Anger subsided quite quickly, but I started to think about self-defense after this incident. Often when we are attacked physically or verbally, self-defense happens and there is usually an element of blaming in that, such as, 'You have no right to talk to me that way.' Do you mean When you are saying that blaming falls away with a non-dual sensibility, do you mean that all unnecessary blaming, the ego-based petty whining about other people's behavior, falls away? Would you say that feeling guilty drops away if self-defense happens? Of course, there isn't anybody calling anybody anything, neither anyone defending, but I ask this anyway. Do you still react if someone calls you an asshole? And then this person quotes a passage from the Bible, "But I tell you not to resist an evildoer. On the contrary, whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to him as well." Is this teaching of Jesus the same teaching as understanding that there are no doers? Hope you haven't done your May talk yet, but if you have, then maybe you could take my question to your June talk. All right, so obviously this didn't make it to the talk at the beginning of May. So here we are at the beginning of June. So this person has experienced to some degree that the automatic knee-jerk response to blame people for their behavior has fallen away to some degree, because this person has realized that we aren't personally doing our own life, and no one else is personally doing their life. So everyone is behaving in the only way possible in any particular moment, as the simple expression of existence itself. And to realize that is going to cut through the usual attitude that people are personally in charge of their lives. So with that earlier assumption that people are personally doing their life, they are making their decisions, and that they are personally responsible for their decisions, then very quickly we can adopt an attitude of praise or blame to an individual for their particular behavior. When the realization comes that there is no personal doing, that no one is personally deciding to see life the way they see it or to function the way they function, they are simply the expression of existence itself, then the feeling of praising and blaming people for their behavior falls away to some degree. And it's different for each person. Now, this particular person is wondering how far this can go. Can this sense of blaming or praising other people, can that fall away totally, so that there is never any sense of blaming another person for their behavior? And I would say, from my own sense of existence, yes, that's entirely possible, that there is no way you can blame another person for their particular behavior. You can't see it as them being personally doing something to you that's offensive. However, on a day-to-day basis, that doesn't mean you don't necessarily get annoyed with certain behavior. So, for instance, if there's a nasty little dog in your neighborhood, and every time you walk out your door in the morning, that dog rushes up and tries to bite you on the ankle, you don't necessarily blame the dog for making some kind of decision to bite your ankle. However, that behavior is really annoying, and you may actually get quite frustrated with it. And frustration, very strong frustration, is a certain kind of anger. In the same way that it's recorded that the Buddha would sometimes get frustrated with some of his followers to the point that he would say something very cutting to them. Or he would speak in an angry tone. Now, this person is asked, you mean that when you say that blaming falls away with a non-dual sensibility, do you mean that all unnecessary blaming falls away, in a situation of self-defense, when there is usually an element of blaming, such as, you have no right to talk to me that way? And this person goes on to ask if the ego-based petty whining about other people's behavior falls away. And also, does the feeling of guilt drop away if self-defense and blaming occurs? And this is where this situation of non-duality becomes tricky, because I can't tell you that if you are expressed with a non-dual sensibility, that your behavior or your attitude or your ideas about existence are going to be one way in particular. Within the world of apparent form, each and every human being is unique, and that applies to each and every human being that has a so-called non-dual sensibility. Now, some apparent people with a non-dual sensibility are quite dramatic, quite dynamic in their personality, quite expressive, quite emotional in their expression, and others are not. So I can say that if there is a non-dual sensibility, really the bottom line would be that you can't really personally blame anybody for their behavior. However, that doesn't mean that that particular storyline won't come up. The storyline may come up, and it may carry certain emotional aspects to it, even though you know that that storyline is false and you don't believe that there is any personal doing in existence. So perhaps another example of this would be that if you go to a movie, you know that when you're sitting in the theater watching the movie isn't some true life situation. The movie is a fantasy. And yet, when you focus on that storyline is going to carry certain emotional aspects to it, and that becomes part of the entertainment of the movie, that you go through this emotional aspect of the movie. Yet you know the movie isn't the truth. So with realizing that the movie is not a true life situation, you go through all of the emotional upheaval of the movie, and ultimately it doesn't really carry any huge impact because it's just a story. So in the same way, you may realize that there is no personal doing in existence, and yet certain statements like, you have no right to say that to me, may arise, or within a certain apparent situation, all kinds of thoughts may come and go, and they may come with a certain emotional impact, but there is also the realization that those storylines are not ultimately the truth, and that the bottom line is that whatever's happening in this moment is a totally unexplainable happening, simply happening spontaneously. And in that realization, the emotional dance of the moment, what we might call the emotional dance of the moment, doesn't really carry any big impact because it's all simply part of a fantasy, and you know it's a fantasy. But it doesn't stop the fantasy from arising and dancing around with a certain amount of emotional aspect to it. So The Buddha got annoyed with some of his followers. The Christ got annoyed with certain situations. Jiddu Krishnamurti got annoyed with certain situations. Yuji Krishnamurti got annoyed with certain situations. But ultimately, it wasn't a big deal. As Jiddu Krishnamurti used to say, I don't really mind what happens. So he's really stating that no matter how life expresses him, ultimately it doesn't really matter to him, because he knows there's no option. Existence itself is expressing each and every apparent being. And each and every apparent being is the totally unexplainable happening of that we might call existence. So however it expresses any one of us is ultimately okay, even if on a day-to-day basis there are certain what we might call petty annoyances that come up with the storylines that still present themselves. So as this person asks, you know, does the feeling of guilt drop away if self-defense occurs? Yes, ultimately the sense that you're personally responsible for that, that fades. However, our storylines may still arise in a way that there is what we might call a feeling of guilt associated with a certain perspective, even when we know that that perspective isn't ultimately the truth, and the guilt has no foundation. One of the realizations involved with a non-dual sense of existence, I mean, perhaps the main one, is that the moment you realize this non-dual sense of existence, the moment that arises, with the basic sense that there's no way of saying truly what any of this is, and there isn't any self or person existing apart from the happening of this moment, that everything we apparently are is simply an expression of this unexplainable happening, the moment that realization arises, from that point on, you no longer are concerned, ultimately, with how life is going to express itself. And within the world of apparent form, you're no longer ultimately concerned with how it's going to express you, because there's no option. Life is going to express itself in whatever way it expresses itself, and there is no person doing any of it. There is no person existing apart from this totally unexplainable happening of the moment. Now, this particular teaching of Christ that this person quotes, the quote is, "But I tell you not to resist an evildoer. On the contrary, whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to him as well." So this person is asking if this teaching of Jesus is the same as understanding that there are no personal doers in life, that there is no personal doing in life. And I have no idea what Jesus was teaching with this statement. I can tell you right now, if somebody steps up to me and slaps me across the face, I'm not going to stand there and let them slap me across the other side of my face. I mean, I'm not sure what I'm going to do, but in any particular instance, I know I'm not going to be standing there taking a beating if there's any other possibility. Now, this person also asks if I still react if somebody calls me an asshole.
The only thing I can relate this to is we have one customer in the warehouse that, you know, I've been in the warehouse now for almost 12 years, at around the 10-year mark, there was one customer who was always very difficult to deal with, and because we didn't have a certain product that he wanted one day, he proceeded to spend about 15 minutes calling me a prick and an asshole. And I mean, in one way, I found the whole thing very amusing, that this guy just went totally ballistic just because we didn't have a certain product. And on the other hand, the next time he came in, I just said, I don't really ever have to deal with you again. It's not a very pleasant thing to be doing, and I don't really want to go on dealing with you. So from that point on, my life became a lot easier, because this guy was very much like some nasty little dog that was trying to bite my ankles. And even though I can see that he's not personally responsible for his behavior, the behavior itself was very annoying to me. And I really didn't want to be dealing with it. All right, so a second person has written in saying, Hi Daryl, I am interested in the meaning of the non-dual realization. I have been reading some of Douglas Harding's books recently, which I find fascinating. He would generally go into the mystical, deeper meaning of the experience, quoting a lot of spiritual masters, especially Christian mystics like Master Eckhart. Ultimately, these obviously relate back to Jesus' teachings. Harding implies that there is some deeper meaning to what is happening. For example, that God, the One, decided to be the Many, and therefore set up this creation to realize himself, or something like that. The ultimate meaning of life, therefore, is to find our way back home, to realize who we really are, like the prodigal son. Separation is the foreign country. How do you see this? Is this just a story? Thanks for taking the time to consider this. Kind regards. Okay, so from a classical non-dual sense of existence, what we might call a classical non-dual sense of existence, there isn't any explanation for existence that is true. And in my own sense of it, you know, this story that God, the One, decided to be the Many and therefore set up this creation to realize himself, or the story that the ultimate meaning of life is to find our way back home, to realize who we really are, I mean, these are very romantic, poetic ways of looking at existence, but it's all fantasy. There is no meaning to a non-dual realization. The realization itself, the moment this so-called realization occurs or arises, in that moment, you don't gain anything. Basically, it's losing something. And it's losing a number of things. It's losing the sense that there can be any explanation for the happening of this moment, any true explanation. And it's losing the sense that there is something separate from the moment making any of it happen. It's the sense that whatever this happening of this moment is, there's no way of saying what it is, and there isn't any so-called person existing apart from it. There isn't any so-called person making any of it happen or influencing any of it. So, as that becomes more obvious, there is less and less interest in explanations. There is more and more interest in the living dynamic of the moment that presents itself in a way that we would call seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, smelling, and thinking, all of that moving and shifting and dancing, but there isn't any urge to call it anything. Those labels will still arise, but even those labels themselves are something that can't really be explained. It just happens the way it happens. So with this non-dual realization, there is less and less interest in any explanation and more fascination with the happening of this moment, which is simply occurring spontaneously without any possible way of truly saying what any of it is. It just is what it is. All right, a third person has written in saying, "Hi, Daryl. Thank you so much for offering your perspective on all of this. The seamless nature of whatever this is becomes so clear with your pointing. There is, as always, still a few things that my mind loves to throw up, and I would like to run it by you if that's okay. First of all, you mentioned the buzz and tingle of the moment, that which is felt when there is no thinking. Am I correct in my feeling that this is still an appearance? I mean, this buzz and tingle is felt. It requires the functioning of the senses, the nervous system. I ask because there is also a resonance with the teaching from Nisargadatta Maharaj of being prior to any appearance, perception, experience, awareness, or consciousness, whatever we wish to call it. I wonder if you can talk of this, as it feels that I am unclear, as it seems that any object, the body, a star, a flower, or a sensation, such as buzz and tingle, are at best translations. How they appear is not what they are, but how our senses deem to translate them. A change in chemistry, such as occurs with the use of psychoactive drugs, for example, A change in chemistry with the use of psychoactive drugs, for example, and the object's essence remains, but its appearance in translation by the senses can drastically alter. Essentially, there is a resonance with the nothing prior to manifestation, and translation by the senses, and also with the pointing of the present moment here and now, as it seems to have some thingness, post-translation about it." Okay, that last line seemed a bit confusing, but it's essentially saying there's a resonance both with the idea of a nothing prior to manifestation and translation, as well as a resonance with the present moment, here and now as it is, that does seem to have some thingness. So, very directly, there's a difficulty in using words to point to the happening of the moment, because this basic happening of the moment is not a word. Even what we call a word is not a word. Within our usual storyline, somebody told us to call it a word, but the arising and passing of a so-called word, that's not just an idea. But there's no way of saying actually what it is. So when I'm attempting to consider this unexplainable happening of the moment, I might ask you to think the question, what is there when there is no thinking? And then rest at the end of that and just feel what's occurring at the end of that. Another way of saying it is just acknowledge what's at the end of that question. So at the end of the question, for a moment, there is no thought, but it doesn't feel as though there's nothingness. Now, I'm not saying, this person is saying that that still seems to be some kind of interpretation of the moment through the senses. But actually, when there's no thought, there are no senses. There is no perception. There is no consciousness. There is no awareness. Because all of those are thoughts. All of those are words attempting to describe what's going on in this moment. And in the exact moment when there is no word, There's no description. So whatever seems to be at the end of that question, at the end of that thought, what is there when there is no thinking? There's no way of saying what that is, but it makes itself obvious. That's what Nisargadatta Maharaj was pointing to when he said, simply stand prior to the sense, prior to I am. I am is an intellectual phrase. The mind says I am, or there is basic existence, or there is pure awareness. And what Nisargadatta Maharaj was attempting to point to is drop that too. Drop your most basic intellectual interpretation of the moment and be whatever remains. Now, what we call thought will come back, but perhaps we can realize there's no way of saying what that actually is. Within our usual storylines, we were told to call it thought, but there's no way to say actually what it is. So even when the storylines come back, it's still this which can't really be defined. And to realize that the labels are false, the explanations are false, then even when they apparently arise, there's no fundamental interest in them as far as attempting to discover what one actually is or what life actually is. There's no longer any interest in these definitions, in these labels. There's more interest in the fact that whatever this happening is, we all have the sense that something is happening in this moment right now. There is absolutely no way of truly saying what this is. And that goes for all of these apparent storylines. There's no way of truly saying what this is. It's not a person sitting here sensing existence. It's not a person sitting here perceiving existence. That's a story that's not true. If you go up to an apparent baby that is 1 hour old and you ask the baby, how many senses do you have? What are your perceptions of existence? You're not going to get any response from the baby because you will first have to teach that baby that storyline and get that baby to believe that storyline in order to get a story in response to your questions. The baby isn't lying there thinking, oh, I'm sensing life in a very pure way. So, for instance, some people will say, you have to listen to life with pure awareness. Well, you can't listen to life with pure awareness. You know, when they say pure awareness, they mean awareness without thought. You can't have pure awareness without thought because the idea of pure awareness is a thought. You can't listen without thought because the idea that you're listening is a thought. As Nisargadatta points out, stand prior to I am. He points out that I am is the most basic sense of existing, that there is amness or being. Now that's an interpretation. To say that there is amness or being is interpretation. So he says, stand prior to I am. Stand prior to any interpretation. And in that, he goes on to point out in certain of his teachings that in this realization that the storylines are not telling you what's occurring in this moment, then everything can simply happen. And as far as considering ideas of reality, they become irrelevant because there's no way of saying what any of this actually is. So even if a storyline is arising and passing away, an apparent storyline is arising and passing away, for Nisargadatta Maharaj, it's no problem because he's standing prior to any interpretation of that. He's standing prior to even any interpretation of saying what that storyline is. It's not a storyline. It's not actually something called a storyline. It's not actually something called an idea. There's no way of saying what any of this is. So, whatever the happening of this moment is, whatever, you know, it feels like something's happening, there's no way of saying what it is. To even say that it's a happening is to say too much. Now, whatever this is, it can present whatever it presents, and there's no problem. It's always the case that there's no way of saying what this is. Even ideas of thisness or isness, it just makes no sense. Now, this person's got a second portion to their question. They go on to say, I have heard in various teachings that it's a case of mistaken identity, and there is a tendency... Okay, so some teachers are presenting the notion that our only problem is that we're living in a situation of mistaken identity, and there is a tendency to dismiss my direct findings in favor of fitting in with the teacher's pointing to abiding as awareness or remaining in stillness or be that which doesn't change. But as I look, I never find any solid ground that I can call my identity. I only ever really find shifting sands that cannot hold a foundation of any period for any period of time, never a place to abide. And to me, stillness is merely the absence of movement, duality itself. So why strive to remain there? Yet I try, since the teacher must be right, not fun. You mentioned in a previous talk about your various methods and meditations employed over the years, led by various traditions or teachers. At what point was it enough for you to be your own authority? Many thanks. All right, so these situations can get very confusing. You've got a lot of teachers out there saying, abide as awareness, remain in stillness, be that which doesn't change. And that can be very confusing because all of those are translations, interpretations of what's going on in this moment. On one hand, these people are basically telling everyone that ultimately what's happening here can't be explained in any way whatsoever, but then they say abide as awareness or remain in stillness or be that which doesn't change. All of which are intellectual interpretations of whatever this happening is. And I also found all of that very confusing until it became very obvious that there was actually no way of saying what the happening of this moment actually is. So to say that it's awareness is ridiculous. It's moronic to say that what we are is pure awareness. We all have the feeling that something is happening right here, right now. Everyone who is listening to this particular podcast has the sense that something is happening right here, right now. There is no way of saying truly what any of this is. It's just this, whatever this is. A non-dual sensibility does not remain focused on interpretations, intellectual interpretations. It does not remain focused on ideas as some kind of ultimate goal. As Jiddu Krishnamurti used to point out, there is just this dance of the moment, this movement. It's not arriving anywhere. There's no way of saying what it is. He would point out that if you focus on concepts, you can't learn about this. It's just a simple acknowledgement of the vital dance, the movement, the action, the happening of the moment that can't be explained in any true way, and that is simply occurring spontaneously, automatically. So, as this person pointed out, or is asking, at what point was it enough for you to be your own authority? When it became obvious to me that whatever anybody said about existence, it was bullshit. And, you know, as I've pointed out on many occasions, all of the storylines I use are also bullshit. I enter the usual storylines and I point out their limitation so that ultimately, maybe, there isn't a focus on storylines. Or a belief in storylines. And those apparent storylines can come and go in accordance with their own nature. The way everything is expressing itself in accordance with its own nature, automatically, spontaneously. Whatever this happening of this moment is, there's no way to say what it is. It's just this happening in whatever way it happens. There isn't any person that exists apart from it. There isn't any so-called person making any of it happen or influencing any of it. There's just this happening. And even that's saying too much. All right. A fourth person has written in. Actually, it's the first person who wrote in, writing in again, saying, "Hi, Dee. Trying to reach some standard may or may not happen, but I'm not interested in that. I am interested in the logic of this. When it is seen that there is no one doing anything, it would seem logical that blaming and guilt would come to an end, but to me it seems that this is not going to happen. It seems to me that there is a division about this in non-dual teachings. One group emphasizes that the awakening leads to the end of blame and guilt, but there is one smaller group that says that the awakening or enlightenment does not have anything to do with one's apparent behavior. I count your teaching to be part of this smaller group. Am I correct?" In a way you're correct, and in a way you're not correct. it's very difficult to just make some blanket statement about this. So this person is pointing out that one group of non-dual presenters emphasizes that awakening leads to the end of blame and guilt, which is true even in my situation. I'm saying that ultimately it leads to the end of blame and guilt. It's seen that there is no self doing anything, that everything is simply the dance of this unexplainable happening of the moment, and therefore, ultimately, there's no way to allocate blame, and there's no way to really support the notion of guilt. However, from moment to moment, the apparent storylines still come and go, and those storylines carry a certain emotional aspect. So as I pointed out earlier, if you go to a movie, you know the movie isn't true. And yet when you focus on the storyline, the movie carries a certain emotional impact. So there may be fear, even though it's a movie. Like, you know it's a fantasy, but there still may be fear. And the enjoyment of it is that the movie carries that emotional impact, but there's nothing really to be worried about. It's just a movie. And so it is with all of the storylines that we have in our lives, our parent lives. So there may be the realization that ultimately there actually isn't any storyline. There's no way to say what even that is. However, those apparent storylines still present themselves and they carry with them certain emotional aspects. And even though those emotional aspects may present themselves, ultimately there's nothing to be too concerned about. All of it is simply the totally unexplainable, mysterious dance of existence. Stories of blame and stories of guilt are not ultimately true, even though there's a certain emotional aspect to them. So, again, many non-dual presenters will simply say they're not really concerned with what life presents. Now, that doesn't mean they don't feel what we would call emotions from moment to moment. It's just that no matter what emotions present themselves, they're not ultimately concerned about those emotions because there's no option. Life is going to express whatever it's going to express. There is simply the automatic dance of the moment. It has no particular form. It presents whatever it presents. There's no option. If it presents an urge in you to refine your behavior, that's what it presents. There's no option. If it presents in you a feeling of guilt, there's no need to be concerned. There's no option. It presents whatever it presents. If it presents an urge in you to refine your attitude around guilt, around blame, there's no need to be concerned. That's what it presents. It presents whatever it presents. As the Taoists pointed out, that a sage really wanders around with no concern over what's going to be presented. It's not saying that the sage wanders around without ever having any difficult times or difficult emotions or whatever. It's saying that the sage wanders around with no real concern, just simply awaiting the decrees of heaven. Meaning, the happening of this moment presents whatever it's going to present. With this non-dual realization, it's the realization that there's no self that gets to ultimately say what's going to be presented. Even the apparent self that's being presented doesn't get a say in how existence is going to present that apparent self. Now, Jiddu Krishnamurti would say, "I don't mind what happens," meaning he doesn't mind what happens in any moment, but there are lots of instances in Jiddu Krishnamurti's life where he was very angry with individuals. He carried on a lifetime feud with one of his former close friends because that friend managed to get the copyright to a bunch of Krishnamurti's teachings, and Krishnamurti did not like that. But Krishnamurti didn't mind what happened. So if life presented him as some cantankerous old guy that was carrying on a feud, he didn't ultimately mind that. Or as Alan Watts stated when he was in his 60s, "I don't like myself when I'm sober." Now, ultimately, he didn't mind that because there was no option to it. That's the way existence was expressing him. So maybe one way we could put this is that on a day-to-day basis, there may be all kinds of what we would call emotional upset, but deep down inside or fundamentally, with a non-dual sense of existence, there's no concern about that because all of that is ultimately an unexplainable happening, simply happening on its own. Now, this person said at the beginning of this question that they were interested in the logic of this. Well, first of all, this person said they weren't necessarily interested in trying to reach some standard, but the rest of the question points out that that's not true, since they're really concerned with trying to get rid of the sense of blame and guilt. However, in asking this question, this person has also said, I'm interested in the logic of this. It seems logically that if it's realized that there is no one doing anything, logically blame and guilt would come to an end. So basically there are all kinds of things you can expect life to do, but it doesn't do it. So this notion of logic has to be dumped as well. There is no logic to the dance of existence. So I wrote back to very quickly to say to this person that logic has to go too, and so this person has now asked, maybe you can also talk about logic. It's a bit like trying to deal with flypaper. You get your fingers stuck on flypaper, and then you try to take it off with your other hand, and they get stuck that way. These questions go on and on. But logic. Logic. Well, I've never really considered this before. Logic, in general, would have something to do with just a system of thinking. So a system of thinking would have some kind of would make sense in a certain way. So if we enter a storyline about cause and effect, we can say if a certain thing arises, then there's going to be a certain result. So there would be a certain logic to the way one is looking at existence. And perhaps the most extreme form of logic would be mathematics, so that if you take one banana and you put it on a table, and you take another banana and you put it on the table, then you have two bananas. And that's true in most cases, that one and one make two. However, there are certain forms of math in which one and one is not going to make two, because it's a different way of looking at existence, and so the logic of that other system is different. If you're dealing with mathematics, as far as I know, there are about four general systems of mathematics that are used to calculate certain things in certain specific situations, and they work for specific situations, but they don't work for life in general. So the logic of them, of those systems, works up to a certain point, but then it stops working in another situation, and it becomes illogical. Now, an example of two different systems of looking at life which contain a different logic would be the difference between Newtonian physics and quantum physics. So in Newtonian physics, we look at life in terms of things and cause and effect. So if we look at the world in general, we can speak in terms of cause and effect. If I slap you across the face, you're going to have a certain physical pain from that. So that's logical. That makes sense. Now, if we look at life more closely, in more detail, in smaller and smaller details, then we come to something like Newtonian, or we come to something like quantum physics, which is stating that ultimately there are no things, that everything is basically the dance of energy, and that the apparent things in life are moving in correlation with each other, but it's not cause and effect. So that certain apparent objects at great distance from each other are moving in relation to each other, but it's not a cause and effect relationship. Somehow it gives the impression that it's more one big event. And Einstein, before he died, was attempting to come up with a view of existence, a formula for existence that would describe it as one undivided field of energy. So from the Newtonian view of existence, we have objects and cause and effect. And from the view of quantum physics, there are ultimately no objects and no cause and effect. You can't really put the two together as realities, because one is totally illogical to the other. And this is because the world of thought is simply a way of looking at existence, and from this non-dual sensibility, the non-dual sensibility takes it even further than the world of quantum physics, and it simply states that whatever the happening of this moment is, there's no way of saying what it is, it has no particular form, and there's no way of saying what it is, so even the word energy wouldn't apply to this. The word energy wouldn't apply to it, matter and energy would not apply to it, and the words logical and illogical would not apply to it. These are descriptions that have no ultimate truth to them. These are storylines that are not ultimately a truth. From the non-dual sense of existence, it's simply stating that whatever this happening of this moment is, whatever this is, the feeling that something is happening right now, there's no way of actually saying what it is. And so from the non-dual sensibility, it's always entering the world of storylines and pointing out the limitations of storylines. So, the existence itself is somewhat illogical. I mean, we could look at it that way because, I mean, one great example is that human beings run around trying to define life in one particular way, trying to hold life a certain way in certain situations. They want to hang on to their pleasant thoughts and feelings and sights and sounds and touches and tastes and smells. They want to hang on to those. They want to hang on to their pleasures. They want to hang on to their youth. They want to hang on to their relationships a certain way, when at the same time they wander around saying that absolutely everything in existence is changing. It makes no sense. It's totally illogical that a human being would be doing that, but that's what apparent human beings do. Again, ultimately, from this non-dual perspective, the whole notion that life can be defined as something logical or illogical is ultimately just a storyline. It may be somewhat useful in certain moments, but it's not any true description of existence. What seems to be totally logical in one instance, in one situation, will appear to be totally illogical in another situation, or another instance, another way of looking at it. That brings us to the end of the questions. There doesn't seem to be anything else coming up in response to this last one. And we've got a bit of time left. So, let's see, what could we get into? Keep in mind that whatever I'm offering on this website is just for your consideration. What's being offered is what could be considered to be a classical non-dual sense of existence. It's not necessary that anybody have a non-dual sense of existence. This is just one of the expressions of existence. It's not the one and only expression of existence. To some apparent people, this perspective on existence will make the most sense to them. They will realize that this is how they feel life is actually presenting itself. And to others, it will make no sense. They're expressed in a very different way. So let's just consider some of the basics of this again. Why would you have the feeling that you know what's going on in this moment, ultimately? You all have a story that when you came out of the womb, you didn't have a story. So when a baby comes out of the womb, the baby doesn't have a story that it's a baby coming out of the womb. So what's happening for the baby? What's happening for any apparent baby that comes into existence, that supposedly comes into existence? All that really happens is all of a sudden it feels like something's happening. It's the same as, you know, when we apparently go to sleep at night. The sense that something is happening stops. It disappears. And then in the so-called morning, all of a sudden the feeling that something is happening begins again. Now, for all of us, when this happening first presented itself, there wasn't any storyline. So we all know that with a baby, it's going to take a long number of years for the baby to learn a whole bunch of labels that other so-called people are teaching them, and to string those labels together in a particular storyline. So when this happening first feels like it's happening, when it seems like something's happening, there isn't any storyline. There isn't any way to say what it is. Now, we apparently get taught to call it all kinds of things, but all the people that are teaching us to call it certain things, they also were babies, and they didn't have a storyline. they didn't have any labels and they were taught by someone else. Now, no one is apparently born with a label for existence. And if you live in an English country, you get taught certain labels. If you live in a French country, you get taught another set of labels. If you live in a Russian country, you get taught a different set of labels, and so on. The labels aren't really telling us what this is, fundamentally, the happening of this moment. The happening always remains a total mystery, and then we can point to different aspects of this happening, and we give those different names. The different portions of this great mysterious happening get different names. But the names never can tell us what this actually is. It always remains a totally unexplainable happening. We can point to certain portions of it, but all we're doing ultimately is pointing to one portion of a totally unexplainable happening and giving it a certain name, calling it by a certain sound, giving it a certain symbol. It doesn't essentially tell us what any of this is. Now, if I ask you, what are you doing right now to be the happening you are? You know, you call this happening the body and the mind. So again, you've got two labels that point to something that you don't really know what it is, but you point to different portions of this happening. One you call a body, another you call a mind. So this so-called body and this so-called mind, it's happening the way it's happening. What are you doing to make it happen the way it happens? Like right now, as you're listening to this, what are you doing to be the process you are? The answer is very obvious, nothing. You're not doing anything to be the process you are, to be the happening you are. It's just happening the way it's happening. Now, even if you have an urge to do something, that urge isn't something you create. If you look back through your life and you look back at all the situations you can remember, situations in which you've acted in a certain way, if you really examine those, you'll discover that you didn't create the urge to be interested in doing something. You didn't create the urge to do something. You didn't create the interest to do something. The interest and the urges simply arose. And that apparently provoked a certain action. Now, even in acting, you don't get to decide how you're going to act. You act in the only way you're capable of acting. You don't create your needs, your interests, your concerns, your urges. You don't create how strong those needs, those interests, those concerns, those urges are going to be. And all of that provokes a certain apparent action, your action. And you can only act in whatever way you're able to act, so you don't create your abilities or your lack of abilities. All of this is simply an expression of what we might call the universe or nature. And that's your experience. If you look back through your memory of your life, if you look at what's happening in this moment, you have an interest in listening to this podcast. You don't create that interest. Some of you may feel you have a need to understand this non-dual sense of existence. You don't create that need, that urge. And you don't get to decide how exactly you're going to understand this. You will relate to my apparent words in whatever way you relate to them. You don't get to decide to understand it in a certain way. You understand it in a certain way or you don't. So without going off on retreat, without doing any kind of strange spiritual practice, without having to go to some spiritual master for the answer, really, if we simply examine these two most basic facts of our existence, that we really have no way of saying ultimately what is going on in this moment. It's a totally mysterious happening. There are all kinds of apparent words that we've apparently been taught to call this mysterious happening, but for every one of us, when we were an apparent baby, really all that occurred when we were apparently born is it simply felt like something was happening. There wasn't any way of saying what that was. With the words we have now, we don't ultimately get to say what that apparent happening is. The big happening of this moment, there's no way of ultimately saying what it is. We have all kinds of words that point to different portions of it, and we can make up stories about certain portions of it, but we never get to say what the big happening actually is. It's a totally mysterious happening, an unexplainable happening. And in the dance of this moment, the happening of this moment, it's quite obvious that no one is making any of it happen. If you sit here in this moment and make no effort whatsoever, the happening of the moment goes on happening. The process that you are goes on happening. And even if you are making no effort to do anything, the urge to do something will eventually arise. And the effort to do that, if the urge is strong enough, the effort to do that will arise. All of it occurring spontaneously. So, before we even start considering what's the truth about life, how should we be living life, what's the true spiritual path for any of us to be on, if we simply examine the two most basic facts of our existence, there's no way of saying what any of this is ultimately. And no one's making it happen. No one's making the process that they are happen. It simply happens. Added to that, if we acknowledge the fact that for most of us that have apparently been alive for a fair number of years, we eventually go around saying that everything in life is changing. Our thoughts are changing, our moods are changing, our bodies are changing, our relationships are changing. The cities we live in are changing, the houses that we live in are growing older, they're changing. The climate is changing, the surface of the earth is changing. Whether it comes from our own supposed personal experience, or it comes from the news, or it comes from science, ultimately, everything is saying that everything is changing. So even the idea that we're living in a world of stable things, can't be true. These apparent things are actually movement. And that movement isn't being caused by anyone, and it can't be stopped by anyone. So in these this very simple acknowledgement of what our actual experience is, what everyone's shared experience is, we come to the most profound teachings that all of the great spiritual traditions were expressing, simply saying that the ground of existence is an unexplainable, unformed great spirit or flowing river of life or unformed ocean of existence. Or as the Chinese would point out, there is only the Tao, the way. The way is this dance and the way it dances. It would often be related to the flow of water, that all of life was a flowing. So without doing any spiritual practice, without needing to get into any complex philosophy, if we simply acknowledge the most basic facts of our existence, it goes very directly to the heart of what we might call the most profound philosophical teachings, the most profound scientific teachings, the most profound spiritual teachings, so that there comes the acknowledgement that there's no way of saying what any of this is. It has no particular form. It never will have a particular form. No one is making it happen. These points have been expressed throughout apparent history in philosophy, in science, in spirituality, in art, over and over again. Whether it's process philosophy or the questionings of Schopenhauer, when he noted that we can do whatever we want to do, but we don't create our wants. Or perhaps it's the investigations of science, quantum physics, stating there are ultimately no things, there is only process. Or neuroscience discovering that 10 seconds before we even know we're going to make a decision, the brain has already made the decision. It's already acting in that decision-making process. And it's already indicating what decision we're going to make 10 seconds before we even know we're going to make a decision. Or maybe it's spirituality declaring that there is only the Great Spirit, or that there is only the unformed ocean of existence, and that the various apparent things are simply the waves in the ocean, and that goes for all of the actions. Or maybe it's Einstein saying space and time are not conditions that we live in. They are simply ways of thinking about existence. And in that, he would ultimately include matter, that the matter, space, and time are not actual conditions that are existing. These are simply ways of thinking about existence. This is our shared experience. It doesn't matter whether we're a scientist or a philosopher or some spiritual master. if we actually all sit down and ask ourselves, when we were apparently born, did any of us have an understanding of existence? Does a baby that's 1 hour old have an understanding of existence? The answer is quite obviously no. So how would we have an understanding of what all of this is now? We might have some rudimentary sense of how this whole happening happens in some way, how it presents itself in some way, but there's no way of saying exactly what it is. If we look at our most basic experience of life, all of the apparent forms are changing, so existence doesn't have a form. The descriptions of form can't be a description of existence. Existence has to be some moving, shifting, dancing event if everything is changing. And if we look at our own experience, no one has the experience of creating themselves. Right now, the process that you are, you don't have the experience that you're making that process happen the way it happens. The body functions the way it functions. The brain functions the way it functions. You don't know what your thought's going to be 2 minutes from now, and you don't have to know. It's going to be whatever it is. You're not making that happening of the brain happen. It happens the way it happens. Even in situations where it seems like you're doing something, that you're making a decision to do something, the urge to make that decision came up on its own. You didn't make the urge come up to make a decision. The urge to move in a certain direction, you don't decide what direction you're ultimately going to move. You don't create your needs, your interests, your concerns, your urges. You don't create how strong any of them are going to be in any particular moment. All of it simply happens as an expression of nature. Most of the time we would say it's an expression of nature, or we would say it's the dance of the universe. But from our own experience, it's never actually anybody's personal doing, because the whole process that you are is an expression of nature, is an expression of the universe. Again, all of this is simply for your consideration. What's the point? What do you get from this kind of consideration? Nothing in particular. Maybe you have an urge to consider life in this way. If it becomes obvious that life is a totally unexplainable happening, simply happening on its own, then it will seem as though an entire fantasy, a world of assumptions, of a world of doing and understanding and praise and blame and any number of apparent judgments about existence, all of that will melt away to some degree, but you don't even get to say to what degree they melt away. All of it, again, simply one of the apparent expressions of existence. This totally unexplainable happening, simply happening the way it happens. All of the regrets about life going in a certain direction will fade away, because it will be realized it went the only way it could go. All of it, the dance of this totally unexplainable happening, simply happening. All of the hopes for the future, the concerns about how it might go in the future, there ultimately is no concern. It will present whatever it presents. A Again, all of this is simply for your consideration. Either you relate to it or you don't relate to it. If you do relate to it, that's great. If you don't relate to it, that's just as great. There will be some other sense of existence that will be expressing itself in you. Yeah, that's all that seems to be coming up at this point. So, I wish you a good month ahead. I hope that you get only good things. However, I know you're going to get a mixed bag of things. Until next time, take care. Bye.